Well, this is one of the best organized conferences that I've ever seen. Some conferences start strongly and then they peter out. This one is getting better all the time. We even had steak tonight at the dinner table. More of the men are bringing their wives, and that makes the congregation look better. Dr. McLennan's jokes are getting better all the time, and his speeches longer, as you noticed last night. So things are certainly looking up, I must say. Now tonight we come to a really great topic. The abolition of the laity. And if this could be accomplished, we should have a new Reformation. The first great Reformation was a wonderful time. It had as its most striking slogan, the priesthood of the believer. And every one of us tonight would give lip service to this. But you know very well that it often has been only lip service, that very frequently it has not been thoroughly carried out. The way to complete the Reformation, or to make a new Reformation, is to take it with absolute seriousness. Now, this is a very great difference between Protestantism and all Roman Catholicism. The Roman Catholics, whatever virtues they have, and they are many, do not believe in the priesthood of the believer. And they will tell you they don't. They believe that the priesthood is a separate class with special prerogatives. And they are supposed to tell the lay people what the truth is and what to do and how to live. Now, we at least give lip service to the great doctrine. But whereas the Roman Catholics oppose it, we simply neglect it. And you can have as great a loss by neglect as by opposition. Therefore, in this, we can take no real credit at the moment, except this, that there is a stirring in our life. And it is of this stirring that I would speak tonight. The great text that you heard in what our friend read is this, from the words of the lips of Jesus, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest to send forth laborers. This is really the biblical basis of the doctrine of the priesthood of the believer. The task of making this world the kingdom of Christ is so great that it cannot be limited to a few. We need every laborer we can get. And we are here tonight as a group of men and women, recruiting sergeants, producers of the laborers. Our major task is the task of bringing more laborers into the harvest. It's really as clear as that. This is what you are assigned to do, to stir them up in their ministry, wherever they may be. This is already being done in some places wonderfully well. For example, I'm very proud of one of my old friends, a student at Johns Hopkins in the days that I was there as a graduate student. I wanted to do something on the Hopkins campus, and so I looked around and I saw that the Baptist counselor took all the Baptist names, and the Methodist counselor took all the Methodist names, and so forth. There weren't very many Quaker names. So I went to the registrar's office, and I got the names of all of those who called themselves agnostics and atheists. I thought this was a wonderful ground to work on, and it was. So we organized a club, a luncheon club, which we called the How to Be Religious, Though Intelligent on Wednesday Club. I'm very proud to tell you that three of those boys went to Princeton Theological Seminary. They, of course, were very close to the kingdom. So close that they were fighting it, as is often the case. Well, one of those boys is now a pastor in Columbus, and he has started what he calls the 70 Plan, taking very seriously the story of the sending out of the 70, that is, the rank and the file, as mentioned so brilliantly in Luke 10, in the passage that you all know, when they were sent out with such urgency. He has 70 key men and women in the congregation there, who now are all of them under shepherds, under his direction. Each of these has 5 persons under his care. And those 5 persons are to be handled devotedly and sensitively by the leader. He is to prepare them for Holy Communion. He is to see that they get books to read, that they have magazines, that they get transportation to public meetings when they need it, and great friendship. And he visits in their homes. The result is that that church now has 71 pastors instead of 1. This is exactly like dynamite in any community. And that church there in a suburb of Columbus is just pushing out the wall. Not because this pastor, Keith Conning, is such a brilliant preacher. I don't think he is. But because he understands his task aright. He knows that it is his task to develop the laborers for the harvest. Some variation of this plan could be used by any one of you. There isn't a thing in the world to stop you. You know that something like it has been used by Presbyterian men. It has really begun after an initial undertaking in Kansas City under the direction of Lem Jones, the man who is the president of United Church Men in our nation. And what it has done for some of the communities where it has been tried is just absolutely phenomenal. What this means is that a great many people in the membership begin to understand the joys of the ministry. And they are wonderful joys. Isn't that a fact? It is such a privilege to be able to help people with their reading and with their praying and to guide them in their lives. And instead of the pastor taking all of that to himself, what a wonderfully generous thing if he can share this widely. And then, having shared it widely, bring in distinctive new life. And this is happening with many different terminologies in different places. But I'm sorry to tell you that in the great majority of churches, as I know them, it is not yet being applied. One of the largest churches in this country is a church in which they used to say in their printed material, "This is a staff-controlled church." Now they say, "This is a church of lay ministry." But it hasn't made any real difference. Just a difference in words. And a friend of mine was there recently, and he heard the pastor preach on the responsibility of the average member. And when he came out, he was very sad. Because all that the pastor had said was as follows. Your responsibility is first, to come and hear me preach. Second, put some money in the plate. Third, sing loudly on the next hymn. Now, this sounds like a caricature, doesn't it? I wish it were a caricature. But this is literally the case. There are still thousands of churches in which the pastor is alone in the chancel every Sunday, doing all the preaching, all the public praying, the arrangement for the taking up of the offering, the announcements, and then he goes to the other end of the room and he does all the handshaking. Now that may seem to you hopelessly antiquated from the Southern Baptist point of view. It probably is. But I'll tell you that this is common in just heaps and heaps of places. I'll never forget how shocked I was once in New England when I was having a summer sabbatical. I was in a very lovely town, a picture book town not far from New Haven, with a lovely thin spire on the church with a hole in it, shot by some of Lafayette's men. And, of course, they wouldn't have filled up the hole for the world. And in the midst of this church service, every Sunday that I was there, the pastor did absolutely everything. I was a little surprised that he never asked me to read the scripture. He probably thought I didn't know how to read. But one Sunday, John R. Mott was there. And he didn't ask John R. Mott to do anything either. Now, I know that he knew that John R. Mott could read. The poor fellow simply had no imagination. Or as one of them put it, well, the people will think I'm not doing what I'm paid for unless I do all these things. But there are just lots of pastors who are refusing to share the ministry. They may have many different reasons. I don't know why. But I don't think any of them are good. Now let's see the ways in which it can be shared. And first I'd like to tell you about the development of the Yoke Fellows. I've waited till tonight to tell you this because this seems to me the right place. I began to work, as you know, on this very hard a few years ago. And as the chairman has said, I wrote the only book that is in existence on the priesthood of the believer. The only book in print. The one called Your Other Vocation. At least that is what the publishers say, that it's the only one. Well, a number of men began to write in and say that they believed it. And that if they believed it, they thought they ought to do something about it. Well, this was a very thrilling thing. The first one I remember was a man in Indianapolis. A Methodist. He said, I believe this so much, but I would like to put $1,000 a year in it for 5 years. Then came a wholesale grocer in Fort Wayne. He said, I believe this so much, I'd like to put $1,000 a year in it. Just had a letter from him from Beirut. He's going around the world. And he is trying to see wherever he can go how he can stir up this kind of an interest among the rank and file. Remember, he's not an ordained man. He's a wholesale grocer. Well, then there came in the lawyer in Cleveland with whom I shall be tomorrow night, and who is such a brilliant preacher, Ed Howe, and who's had such a changed life from being an alcoholic to being a real promoter of the Christian cause. Then there came in Bob Greenleaf, head of personnel of the American TNT, who for 20 years had been completely out of touch with the Christian movement. He'd gone to church sometimes, but it had never touched him because he thought no demands were made. He found that all he was supposed to do was to sit there and listen to somebody else preach, put a little money in the plate and go out, and that was all there was to it. And this wasn't big enough to hold him. And here he began to dream of something that would hold him. And now he's in it clear up to his neck. I could go on and name these men right across the country. There was Clarence Johnson, who was the vice president of the Purina Company in St. Louis. This thing got under his skin. He resigned his position as the vice president of Purina when he was just ready for the big money. And then gave himself to his church, the Southern Presbyterian Church. And the result was he became the head of the Program of Progress of it and had 18 wonderful months before he died. I saw him just outside of Atlanta a month before he died. And he said this had been the most thrilling thing in his life. You see, he had been a Christian who was a listener and an observer and a supporter. And then suddenly he moved over and he became a Christian who was a promoter, a producer, a participator. And it put him in a completely different relation to the Christian cause. He, though a miller, began to have some of the joys that come to pastors. He found that he could preach, and he loved it. And all of us know that the wonderful thing about preaching is what it does for the preacher. It may not do much good to the people who hear it, but it's wonderful for the preacher. Often he begins to believe what he says after a while. And this is what Clarence Johnson found was his own case. Well, I don't need to name you more of these. Now, of course, that there are women in it. And so, 2 years ago, January, a group of these came together from every denomination, utterly on their own, and they said, we want to form something within Protestantism, a little bit like the orders of the Middle Ages, as when the Franciscans came together, or the Jesuits, or the Dominicans. And so they decided to form the Order of the Yoke Fellows, with the obvious symbol from the words of Jesus when he says, take my yoke upon you. And they adopted this symbol that's in my lapel here. These are going out so fast now that there are over 6,000 of them being worn by men and women. There's the one for the men with the button at the back of the lapel, the one for the men like this, the one for the women with the pin through the dress, but the exactly like in front. Anybody can wear it who means business in being really committed to the promotion of the Christian cause. And there is not a day goes by now without a call for it and for the discipline cards, which people can sign and have witnessed and then carry always in their wallets and thus become card-carrying Christians. Why not? The communists do it. These ideas were ours long before they were theirs. This is what it says on the card. As one who seeks to submit his will to the will of Christ, I humbly undertake to wear his yoke in the following ways. The discipline of prayer, to pray every day, preferably at the beginning of the day. Second, the discipline of Scripture, to read reverently and thoughtfully every day a portion of Scripture following a definite plan. Third, the discipline of worship, to participate each week in the worship, work, and fellowship of a local church. Fourth, the discipline of money, to give a definite portion of my annual income for the promotion of the Christian cause. Not hit and miss, you see. Five, the discipline of time, to employ my time in such a way that I do not waste God's gift, but make a daily Christian witness, particularly in my regular work. Six, the discipline of study, to develop my understanding and insight with a regular study of serious Christian books. Mention was made yesterday of the Church of the Savior. I don't know whether Dr. Campbell is still here or not. I don't see him at the moment. You all know that it's his brilliant son-in-law who is the pastor there. All of the people in the Church of the Savior carry a card like this, everyone. One result is that with 60 members, they now have an annual budget of $62,000 a year. And not a rich person among them. Because, you see, they have accepted a more serious level of what Christian commitment means. And I can tell you again that I think it is the most infectious fellowship that I know in the United States. And one of the things that Gordon is doing now is to drive out the older and stronger members so that they join other churches and become new centers of life in them. And that's why they have only 60 members after going 9 years. But the thing is very exciting when you see it. And you get back to something like the vigor of first century Christianity. Well, this is what the Yoke Fellows are trying to do across the country. And it is receiving an acceptance beyond any that anybody ever imagined. The Lilly Foundation is now giving $15,000 a year to help make this possible, so that there can be conferences, literature, travel, and the thing probably has a glorious future. The next step is that of making a Christian institute.
Has it occurred to you
that when people want to enter the public ministry as clergymen, it is very easy for them to find places to study? You know the many theological seminaries. Think how many the Baptists have. When Clarence Johnson made his great decision, he looked around for a place where he could study, where men like him were the natural students. And he found that, so far as he could learn, there was not one in the United States. This is a very great shock to learn. We're obviously going to change that. And now our next great proposal is to build an institute of universal ministry, where ordinary men and women who are members of churches can come for short periods for an intensive study. Those who already want to do it but don't know how, they need the know-how, they need the follow-through. And we talk now about the parallel of the Lenin Institute in Moscow. How powerful it has been for the communist cause. This is how Mao Zedong and others got their skill. They went there and learned, and then they went back to China and were able to take over. We need to have these Christian institutes that are of this nature for the rank and file of committed members, and this is what we do not now have. If you have produced any in the Baptist Church, I'd like to hear about them, because I don't happen to know of one. At this moment, I know that sometimes persons who are not working for ordination can go into theological seminaries, but they are not at the center of the interest. And often they feel like country cousins. What we need is an institute in which they are at the center of the interest. We are now applying to several of the big foundations, especially the Alcoa Corporation and the Firestone Corporation, for money to make this possible. And we have a great deal of reason to think that it will be done. Bob Greenleaf of AT&T is the one who is working most on what such a curriculum could be. He's already worked at Wainwright House in Rye, New York, in connection with the Layman's Movement for a Christian World. And so these things are just seething. This is where the new life today is emerging in the Christian movement. In case you have never noticed the biblical background of these ideas about the yoke as the symbol of togetherness and of work, you find it especially at the end of the 11th chapter of Matthew, when Jesus says, "Come to me, all ye who are laboring and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." You might suppose that he'd say the rest of the couch. Quite the contrary. He says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, and you'll find rest for your souls." More labor, togetherness, discipline. It's a perfectly wonderful symbol. I have every reason to think that he must have made ox yokes in the carpenter shop at Nazareth, and that this is the outcome of his work. "For because my yoke fits, my burden seems light." And then, St. Paul, in writing to the Philippians, says, "And I ask you, true yoke fellow, help those women, for they labored side by side with me." The striking thing here is that he does not explain the term. He assumes that it is understood. And this makes it reasonable to suppose that this was a common term for a Christian, one who was a yoke fellow with Christ and with other Christians. Now, what this would amount to would be universal evangelism. Now, all of you as Baptists are greatly concerned with evangelism, as you ought to be. And I congratulate you on it. But you surely know this, that evangelism cannot be limited to a few professionals. If so, it is ruined. It has to be the work of the average person, always in their pitching day after day. And what we ought to assume is that when a person becomes a member of the Christian cause, he is accepting this responsibility to reach other people. All of us have crucial experiences in our lives. I'd like to tell you about one that I think was as crucial in mine as any that ever occurred. In the winter of 1939, just 7 months before the war started, I was a fellow of Woodbrook in England, got very well acquainted with a young fellow named Dennis Hoyland. He was the son of Jack Hoyland. Some of you know Jack Hoyland's work, especially his prayers for use in an Indian college. And one day, Dennis asked me if I would go to a meeting with him. Now, I didn't know what kind of meeting it was, but because I knew Dennis and liked him, I said yes. I can tell about this easily now because Dennis was killed in the war, fighting on the Italian front. And when I got there, to my amazement, I found that I was in the meeting of a communist cell. Meeting in a reasonably secret place. If it had been generally known, they might have lost their job. Here I found 9 young men, sharp, able, and alert. And the thing that struck me most was that the way they began their meeting first was to check attendance. They weren't going to have any of this lax attendance. If a man missed twice, he was out. And one fellow was absent that night, and so they appointed somebody to go see him and see why was he becoming lax or what. Then they went around the room, and each of these 9 men told what he had done for the communist cause since they last met. Everybody was a worker, don't you see? One told how he had infiltrated a labor union and got himself appointed an officer. Another one told how he'd written an article for the newspaper and slanted it their way. Another one had given a speech for a woman's club, and so on around the circle. The point was, there were no observers. They were all on a team. And I sat there deeply moved because I immediately thought of the hosts and hosts of Christian gatherings that I'd been in, where no such demand was made. And where if you just came, it was counted very good. Wasn't so with them. And I knew that night that we couldn't possibly match up to that kind of vigor unless we had a still greater vigor. And that this vigor must be shown by a kind of Christian organization in which each of the persons would indeed be a participator in a cause. And then I went back to the New Testament and I found that this is what early Christianity was. In early Christianity, each one was a recruit. The master told the slave, and the slave told the master. The merchant told the customer. The teacher told the student told the teacher. Everyone was indeed an evangelist. And it's easy to imagine them coming together to report what they had done. And thus they were able to win in the face of a pagan order. Now the abolition of the laity would involve the bringing back of this ideal to the entire Christian movement. It is easy to see that this has to be done with imagination. It can't be done by just going up to a man on the streetcar and saying, "Brother, are you saved?" This doesn't work. It's got to be far more imaginative than this. Think how it is being done today by some of the people that you know. Yesterday I mentioned Dr. Scott, the physician of Fort Wayne who has done so much with his fellow physicians. But there's one thing I didn't know about him until just last month. I was up in the Susquehanna Valley, And here came a very striking young couple, about 28 or 29 years of age, a very able young woman and her husband, and they were just as keen as they could be in the promotion of the Christian cause. And naturally, I asked them what got them started. Well, they said, we were on a visit to Indiana to see our parents. And our little girl became ill. And so we went to the Doomling Clinic in Fort Wayne, and Dr. H.B. Scott served our little girl. And he was able to give us the help that we needed so that she became well. But we had to be there a good many days. And he said, in the course of his talking to them about their little girl's illness, he made such a Christian witness, so intelligent and so able, and talked to them about religious books and so forth, that he got them started on a completely new life. Isn't this a good story? It may happen much more than we know, but this is the way it has to happen. Now, Dr. Scott has a brilliant pastor in the First Presbyterian Church, Jack Meister. But this young man and woman from Harrisburg never saw Jack Meister. And it may be that they never will see him. And they may never hear him preach, though he preaches very well. But they did listen to the doctor who was sitting there in his office in the clinic. This is how it can be done. In our town of Richmond, Indiana, there is a furniture man named Duning, D-U-N-I-N-G. He is the man who has been the main distributor throughout this nation of the head of Christ that I have no doubt some of you have in your wallets at this moment. He now has practically retired from the furniture business. He sends out about an average of 1,000 a day. And what a joy has come to this man. This may not seem to you to be a very important thing. I don't know whether you think it is or not. But he gets letters and letters from people who say, this is the thing that has helped them to hold straight in crucial moments. And who's doing it? A furniture dealer. And why not? He is demonstrating the priesthood of the believer. What a leaf we can take from the Mormons in this regard. You all know that nearly every young Mormon has to go out for at least a year as a missionary at his own expense. But more than that, in the city of Salt Lake, the whole city is divided into stakes and the stakes into blocks. And two men are responsible for every block. And they have to be there within 24 hours when a new family moves in to present the claims of the church to those people. Just the way the gas company does. And why not? If you could only see in Salt Lake City how they are succeeding, you would know that this is something of great importance. And of course, they have no clergy. They have really abolished the laity. And this is the major secret of their power. Notice we do not say abolish the ministry. What we want is not less but more. It's the laity that must be abolished. We have no place for the passive ones. A great many people would like to think now of what are the tasks that could be done. I've written down here 20 to suggest to you. If some of you would be good enough to add to these, I should be very glad. And I want you to realize that one of the biggest tasks of the pastor is to be the person who thinks up these tasks that are needed and gets the right people in them.
The first is preaching. There are lots of places where there are some people who can preach much better than the pastor. And they ought to be given a chance, not just on Layman Sunday either. Many of them grow wonderfully by this. Another is reading the scripture and public prayer. I hope you won't think that I'm just giving lip service to this without practice. In 10 years at Stanford University, as chaplain of the university, I vowed that I would never be in the chancel alone. And so I wasn't. We used 900 different men and women in that period. And whatever vitality came largely in this way. Of course, you have to train them. But that ought to be the pastor's task. Week after week, I would take two people, one to read the Old Testament lesson and one the New Testament lesson, and they would read it and reread it until the thing just went deeply into their lives. And it was always noticeable in later years that the passages that they remembered best were the passages that they had read. But the great thing about it was that ever afterward, they felt that they were on the inside. It moved me very much to find that at the beginning of this 10-year period, the average attendance was 180, and at the end of the 10-year period, the average attendance was 1,800. And so far as I know, it chiefly came from this fact of participation in the services. Third is adult education. Now, here is a frontier that is just practically untapped. Oh, I know we have the Sunday schools, of course. But usually the period is so brief that you can't go very far. Have you gentlemen really put in practice in your churches a plan of serious education, usually in which the pastor is the teacher, to use the New Testament phrase? Have you had courses in the great books? A group of men and women where you teach them Augustine's Confessions and the Little Flowers of St. Francis and the Imitation of Christ and the prayers of Lancelot Andrews and Pascal Pontes and so forth. They can take these just as well as they take any great books. And how they do thrill to it. I'd like, especially for the sake of the women here, to tell of Pauline Trueblood's experience, since she is not here and will not be anymore to tell it. She became convinced that something very important was needed for the women. This was at Stanford University in Palo Alto. She saw that these were brilliant homes, but that the children were almost wholly illiterate, religiously. The women kept coming to her and saying, "Won't you give us books of Bible stories for children?" And she'd say, "Why don't you read the Bible to them?" And the women all said, "Oh, we don't know how ourselves." And they were right. So she saw that what was needed was the education of the women. And she determined to put it on a high level. So she went and made calls on 50 women who had children between the ages of 6 and 18, that is school age. She limited it to that. And she got 50 women to say that they would give this a real priority in their lives as a serious educational venture. They decided to study the prophets of Israel in the order of their historical appearance in writing. Amos, Hosea, Micah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so on. Well, this was as fresh as a new day for these women. These were bright women with good brains, but they'd never given their brains to anything like this. And how they loved it. And then she went out to get the teachers for this. She tried to get the finest she could get anywhere. She got Reinhold Niebuhr to give one of her classes. The one on 2nd Isaiah was given by James Meilenberg of Union Seminary, New York, who is undoubtedly the best man in that field. She decided that if this was worth doing, it was worth doing exceedingly well. We got the fine books on the prophets and had these in the library and passed around from woman to woman. And the thing was an absolutely stunning success. And now, after 10 years, when we go back there, this is what we most hear about. Now, why do I tell that to you? Because this is what you could do. No pastor started that. Just a housewife who had a concern, an idea, and a need that she understood. This is an example of the kind of thing that could be done in adult education in the church, where often today we are doing absolutely nothing. A fourth task is that of running a coffee hour. The coffee hour has been a great success in many churches. I'll be on Sunday in Christ Church in Shaker Heights. I can just see now what it's like. Such a crowd as will just almost tax all the capacities they have it every Sunday. And between the 9:30 service and the 11 o'clock service, in a great big social hall next to the sanctuary, they'll have 10 men serving coffee. And then at 12, they'll have another 10 men serving coffee. The last time I was there, I asked their rector how many people had to be there that day, and he counted 251. Different ushers at each service, different choirs at each service. Every device used to make more people feel like insiders instead of observers. And the coffee hour is one awfully good way. And the coffee doesn't cost very much, even if it's 90 cents a pound or whatever it is. It's more than worth it in the value of the fellowship. A fifth task is that of running a book table, like the book table that you have out here in this hall. You can have one in every church every Sunday in the lobby. And thus get books into the homes. The first time that I saw this really successful was in London, when I, as a very young fellow, went to hear Maud Royden preach. And I was thrilled with what she said, because she preached about Albert Schweitzer. He was not very well known, and that was 32 years ago this summer. But the thing that thrilled me and pleased me most was that out in the lobby she had a great big table with 200 copies of his book, On the Edge of the Primeval Forest, and 10 girls out there selling them like hotcakes at the end. I bought a copy, I've carried it everywhere for 32 years, and I've been grateful all the time. And when I hear anybody bring up any silly talk about the sale of books defaming the Holy Temple, I think about this. Buildings were made for men, not men for buildings. And the spread of the gospel is what we're concerned with. A sixth one is that of greeting strangers. A seventh one is that of visiting in homes. The members ought not to sit back and wait to be visited by the pastor. They ought to be the visitors instead of the visited. It's quite a task to organize it, but it certainly succeeds. An eighth one is that of babysitting for young couples. This is especially important for older women, who often sit around and wring their hands and wish they had something they could do, and they don't even see this obvious thing. If they go into these homes and say, let me sit with your children tonight while you go to a meeting, or while you do anything that you want to do, it would be extremely well received. But do you know any churches where it's really done? There may be a few, but there are mighty few. A ninth one is youth leadership. This, of course, many of you already have. And number 10, teaching in the Sunday school, which, of course, you already have. Number 11, physical work on the building. Often it is far better to have the members do the physical work than to hire it, even if you have the money, because the spiritual byproducts are so great. At Cumberland, Maryland, in the Presbyterian church there, they have old pews, 100 years old, that were just so covered with grime that you couldn't see the original walnut at all. Well, they have divided up those men so that, say, three men will come and work on one pew one evening. It's taken them about a year to do it, but oh, how they rejoice in it now, and they're so proud of it, because the walnut just shines. They could have hired somebody, because they're a wealthy congregation. But it was so much better to do it this way, to have participation. A 12th one is cooking.
which we must never despise. It's a good thing. 13 is organizing prayer groups. A week ago today, down at Montreat, a man came and handed me this calling card. He's a man from Roanoke. I didn't see what was on it right away, and it moved me very much when I read it. He says, "As an aid to discipline, I promise that I will start a prayer group. Sincerely yours, Bill." Well, he's an insurance man, an investment expert also. He's not a pastor, but he'll start a group all right. And there may be new life as a result of it. And almost any one of you could give somebody the idea of doing that in your church. And on this matter of little groups, I just want to dispel one danger in your minds. One of you came to me and said, "This sounds like an awfully good idea, but wouldn't it give a sense of there being cliques in the church?" Well, there is that conceivable danger. But it is not likely, and I have not seen it occur, and I would especially like to say this: don't be so timid that you never start anything because it has dangers. On that basis, nobody would ever get married. Anything worthwhile has dangers. Of course it does. The thing to do is to know what the dangers are, recognize them in advance, and prepare for them. And if you have a group that is a really disciplined group, they will be so humble that they will not be a superior clique. Number 14, vocational evangelism. That is, helping people to work through their daily toil, as we discussed yesterday. Number 15, money raising. Number 16, writing. Lots more people could write who don't. Just think of the wonderful value of the writings of C.S. Lewis. Of course, he is not an ordained man. He has written more brilliantly on Christian subjects than almost anybody in our time. I have no doubt that there are men and women in this room who have a gift of writing that has never been developed, and that you have people within your congregations who have such gifts. See if you can develop these gifts by encouragement. Number 17 is counseling. The counseling job is so big that we cannot limit it just to a few professionals. This is one of the things that Bob Greenleaf is especially working on at Wainwright House at Rye, New York, and doing so with great success. Number 18 is business management. Especially in a big church, it's a wonderful thing if a man who is skilled in business management will come in and offer his time to set the pastor free for more prophetic duties. You know that in some places this is becoming a full-time responsibility. And wherever it happens, it seems to be succeeding. For example, in the First Presbyterian Church at Tallahassee, they've just put in such a businessman there. And I know they're doing it also in several of the Baptist churches in the South. Number 19, the planning of missions. The most successful preaching mission that I happen to know in the United States is at Bridgeton, New Jersey. And the man who runs that is a printer. A man who has arthritis so badly that his bones are rigid and he can never sit down. And when he goes to the meetings, he has to stand through all the meetings. But that man now, for 10 years, has been organizing a preaching mission in Bridgeton that is just a stunning success. In a sense, he's a layman. He earns his living as a printer, but he has found this as his ministry. And you might have people in your churches who would have a similar ministry. Number 20 is the ministry of music. Well, I hope that you will tell me, others, that I have forgotten to mention. You probably will.
I think it would be a very good thing for us to make up a list, and that all of us could use it, and have people check this off. Just as they give their money, have them give their time. I mentioned the Mormons. Let me end with another Mormon story. In January, the new Mormon temple in Los Angeles was opened, and they let us Gentiles go for a while until it was consecrated. I had the privilege of going through it. I was very much impressed. Of course, I was impressed with the building. I think it cost $20 million. And they didn't have to make a drive to raise the money. They just wrote a check because they've already got the money because every member tithes. But that wasn't what impressed me most. What impressed me most was the people who were sharing in the enterprise. We counted 60 men and women who were there as guides and information officers, handing out literature and taking people through on the tours of the temple. I found that they were there in two shifts of 5 hours each day, making 10 hours in the day. That meant they used about 900 men and women each week. And those people felt that they were right in there participating. It was their enterprise. And I knew how weak most of us are as Protestants are, because most of us haven't even come anywhere near such a standard as this. But this is clearly the standard at which we should aim. This is what the priesthood of the believer would mean. We're too much stuck in old patterns. We'd better get a new look. And this is the time for us to have it.